Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out, talking to you from a lovely day in North Carolina. And I should probably do just be totally quiet because our guest has so much information in his head that he could do a full 1 hour monologue. How about that, Robert?
Oh, I don't think so, Bill. I think a dialogue's in order.
Okay. Robert Newman, PhD, is the president and a director of the
National Humanities Center.
That's a word that has a lot of second or third syllables. Humanities, humanitarian, humanistic. Where does humanitarian fit?
Oh, well, humanitarian fits quite solidly in the realm of humanities. I think through studying the humanities, we learn how to become more humane and how to become good humanitarians.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that shortly, but let's talk a little bit about you. You've been here how many years? Not too many years.
I am in my sixth year here as president and director of the National Humanities Center.
And looking at your biography, you had quite an interesting and intellectually satisfying career at the University of Utah.
I did. I was the dean of the humanities, of the College of Humanities at the University of Utah for 14 years. Also a professor of English while I was there, and I was about to go back into the classroom and to writing books, and the opportunity to come and lead the National Humanities Center arose, and it's just a wonderful institution, and I could not resist.
Well, it's an institution that a lot of us don't know much about, and I'm sorry to say that I'm one of the people who may have heard of it, but even though it's only a few miles from where I live, it's an organization that doesn't get its name in the daily press very often, or the hourly news shows on television. So, but it certainly is making an impact based on what I've read about it on your website, and particularly. We'll talk about the fellows that come and study there and make a contribution to our society. But you are a graduate with your PhD from University of North Carolina, right down the road in Chapel Hill.
Yes, I am. I did my PhD in English at UNC Chapel Hill. I actually grew up in Philadelphia and had a rather circuitous pathway into academia, but landed when I was in my 20s at UNC Chapel Hill, got a great education in terms of the history of British and American literature, and then wrote my dissertation on James Joyce's Ulysses and launched into my academic career.
Okay, now you started out at Penn State, I guess, because you were in you live in Philadelphia, and is that the place to go when you're a young man in Philadelphia?
Well, so my background is a little bit anomalous in that I am a first generation college student. I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Philadelphia, and my father in the 40s quit high school to join the Navy, and he was a war hero. He got a Purple Heart and the D-Day invasion in Normandy. And my mother was a government clerk. But both of them had a passionate belief that the road to a better life was through education. So even though they were not well-educated themselves, they imbued in their children the thirst for a good education. And growing up in a kind of working-class neighborhood, I knew about Penn State and not many other universities, so that's where I applied, and that's where I did my undergraduate work.
Well, I think that's great. That's a great little history that you've given us about your family, because it's important to you're an example of a lot of Americans at your age, at my age, that had families that came from lesser academic backgrounds than ourselves. So we've had opportunities to become educated one way or another. So back to where you are now at the National Center. It's an elaborate organization. Your website is loaded with information about the organization, particularly the fellows that you have, and we'll talk about that later on in the show. But what are you trying to reach through the center? It says something about, as I read some of your write-ups, making insights available both inside and outside the academic world. Can that be broadened a little bit?
Sure. Let me give you a sort of snapshot history of the center and talk about our mission as well. So the center was established in 1978. We're about 42 years old, roughly. The first class of fellows came in 1978. And it's a treasure in North Carolina. So we are the world's only independent institute for advanced studies that is exclusively devoted to advanced studies in the humanities. So we're on par with the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, which was formed around Einstein, which has its primary focus in math and science, and the Center for Social and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, which focuses primarily in social sciences. So we are the major national institute in the United States for the humanities. And you know, the history is somewhat interesting because when the American Academy of Arts and Sciences decided that we needed a National Institute for the Humanities on par with those at Princeton and Stanford, there was a lot of debate around the country, and a number of interest groups formed amongst scholars. And when they decided to move forward, initially it was thought it was going to be in Boston or New York, kind of the centers of intellectual interest. But the then head of Wachovia Bank, Archie Davis, got together with the then head of the UNC system, Bill Friday, and the Research Triangle Park had been built relatively recently. And they felt that the park was a great place, given the shifts in the economy in North Carolina to a more knowledge-based economy away from tobacco and textiles and furniture making, to establish such a national center for the humanities. And they made the bid, and lo and behold, they won. And thus we opened our doors in this beautiful glass building. The roofs are completely glass. We're in the woods in North Carolina. And a part of the mission of the center is to let the outside in and the inside out as well, as you were alluding to earlier. So our mission's threefold. The scholarly mission brings in roughly 35 to 40 fellows from all over the world each year for an academic year, usually to work on a book project, and it's extremely competitive. We typically admit about 5% of those who apply. We typically have 600 to 700 proposals annually. And scholars that have been here since 1978, they've published over 1,600 books. from work done here. And those books have won all the major prizes in the world, the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, all the major prizes in the disciplines. We also have a very robust education program, which is vetted through former fellows. So it has a scholarly credibility that is unparalleled for online education. And that program, the materials, the webinars that we do, and the curricular material that we generate is used by up to 3 million educators, typically high school teachers, on an annual basis throughout the country.
Explain that again now. Explain what you're talking to about related particularly to educators, high school
sure
teachers. So I
guess we put on webinars that are typically conducted by former fellows, largely for high school teachers, community college teachers, sometimes college teachers as well, that they use to drill down in materials that they're going to use in the classroom. We put up curricular materials for them, again, vetted through typically former fellows. So they have a kind of scholarly credibility that most online education materials do not have. We also do professional credentialing programs for educators, typically high school educators throughout the country as well. And those materials are so rich and useful that, as I mentioned, we typically get about 3 million educators accessing those materials annually. So that's another facet of what we do in terms of reaching out beyond the center. The third facet of our mission is public engagement. So we feel very strongly that we need to be advocates nationally for the humanities, because the humanities, quite frankly, has gotten so much bad press in the past couple of decades. And we feel that we need to be advocates. We need to put a humanities lens on some of the crucial issues that we have in contemporary America. And we put on various conferences about new fields in the humanities that have impact generally on people's lives. So we try to be an influencer from using the materials, the lenses, the methodologies of the humanities, so that the general public also understands the importance and the significance of the humanities to good governing, as well as to a fulfilling life.
Okay, to the general public, I'm one of them. How does the work that you're talking about eventually drift into my environment so that my life will be influenced one way or the other by some work or efforts that were created at your center?
Sure. You mentioned our website, and there's so much material on our website, and that's quite intentional. So we try to increasingly through our programs to drive people to our website. So, for example, we do a podcast series annually called Discovery and Inspiration, where typically we're doing sort of snapshot interviews with our fellows, having them talk to a kind of NPR type audience about their work and trying to translate the dimensions of that work to how they might be useful to the general public, how they sort of transform our understanding of things. We have another program called Nerds in the Woods, where we are kind of repurposing a lot of the podcast materials that we generate around various themes, like casting a humanities lens on issues regarding climate change, or doing a deep dive into how the institution of slavery was embedded initially in the Constitution, or looking at dimensions of the Constitution. We have an international conference coming up beginning this week on artificial intelligence and the humanities.
Yes, I want you to tell us about that.
Sure. So, you know, artificial intelligence is increasingly a significant part of everyday life. It's very influential in how we conduct business, how we live. It proposes to make our lives easier. But there are lots of issues, ethical issues associated with it. So the question of morality, can one program morality into a computer? Can one program empathy into a computer? If we use artificial intelligence for surveillance, where are the limits on privacy? Where are the boundaries on privacy being shifted? The very boundary of what constitutes the self and identity in an artificial intelligence dominated world. So these are all dimensions of this conference that we will be exploring. We already have over 1,000 registrants to this virtual conference from 8 different countries. So it is getting out there significantly into the general public. And the presenters in the conference come from all different fields, from medical fields, legal fields, humanities scholarship, from nanoscience and engineering. We have filmmakers that focus on issues of artificial intelligence. We have artists that use, that create their art through machines, machine-driven art, and get into questions on what constitutes creativity if you can have machine-created art, and where does the human come in? So again, a very, very rich conference. And we also have a webinar that will be tomorrow night from our education program, where we have a school teacher in Washington State who's talking about how she uses artificial intelligence in her classroom for educators. So multidimensional, and these are the kinds of conferences that we've been doing over the past few years. So it's not just scholars talking to scholars, so that's important too, but it's people from a variety of disciplines and fields who are talking about really relevant and significant contemporary issues and how they impact people from all walks of life.
Yes, I saw your itinerary for the AI conference that you're talking about that starts, I guess, tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And this is for the people who know about you and were able to register. Will there be some kind of general public information presented, like press releases or something that I might see an article in a paper or might see in a reasonable news show?
Absolutely. So we have sent all of our materials to about 500 or 600 journalists throughout the world. And we certainly expect that through various journalistic venues that this and through social media as well, that this conference will be covered. Everything will be live streamed, and we archive everything that we do here as well. So people will have the ability to access it at a later date. But registration is free. And if somebody goes to
free?
Yes, everything we do here is free. So nationalhumanitiescenter.org is our website, and one can register for the conference for free on that website and join whatever panels or watch whatever films or view whatever art or attend whatever webinar one wishes to.
Is there an opportunity for the general public to be informed of what you're doing on a regular basis, or can you become a non-contributing member, or do you need to contribute something to get?
Everything is free on our website, and increasingly there's just a ton of traffic. Thousands and thousands of people find our website because there's such a thirst for good content. So people, for example, when they're taking their morning walks with their dogs or on their treadmills, they'll listen to a podcast because typically they're about 20 minutes long, so it's a good amount of time. And they're geared for, as I said, a kind of NPR intelligent general audience. The various repurposing of those podcasts in the Nerds in the Woods series have the same kind of function. So there's an infinite amount of materials that one can get via our website and access and listen to or view. We also have a program that we started a few years ago called Humanities Moments. And this was a campaign, again, to reach out to the general public to get people to think about how the most transformative and influential moments in their lives speak to or from the humanities. How, you know, if you read a really important book or go to a film that just kind of gets you thinking differently or participate in some kind of major historical event, how that often causes people to have an aha moment and to take a turn in their lives as a result. And these things come from the humanities most typically. Moments of great loss in one's life or moments of great love in one's life. These are often humanities moments. So we have hundreds of people that have uploaded roughly 4 to 5 minute moments onto our website. Everything is keyword searchable and meta tags, so one can look for certain themes. So, you know, for example, Ken Burns talks about the moment in his life when he decided to become a filmmaker, and the subtext for all of his films have to do with race. And it goes back to a time when he was 8 years old and he and his family were leaving town and they said goodbye to their African-American caretaker. And little Ken, 8 years old, resisted her embrace when she tried to hug him because she was African-American. And how his father, he relates, shamed him for resisting her and explained what was wrong about that. And he says, from that moment onward, all my work has had a subtext about race. So those great, important, transformative moments in one's life, one can find in what's the archive material having to do with humanities moments. We have moments from Congress people, we have moments from educators, we have moments from filmmakers, from famous authors and novelists, et cetera. And again, everything is keyword searchable if you're looking for a particular theme or trying to look up a particular person. And we welcome people from the general public to upload on their iPhones a humanities moment and send it to us. And we will vet it, curate it, and post it.
Well, I can send you a lot of them since I've been doing this radio show for about 15 years and I've interviewed a lot of interesting people. I've probably got a lot of humanity moments that I could collect and just send you a bucket full of them. But I haven't thought of them in that regard as they might have happened. For example, I had the president of the UNC system on my show once several years ago, just before he left the job, and I had three high school students on the show with him. And the reason I had him and the high school students on the show, he had written and was published in the News and Observer a long piece on liberal education. And so these were three high school students that I knew from the church I went to, one being my step-grandson. And I said, let's see if we could get this group together. And the president of the university staff assistant said, well, I guess that's okay. So we had three high school students and the president of the university sitting in the studio in Carborough talking about liberal education. And they've all three high school students have gone on in various directions. My step-grandson is now going to be starting law school. So these are things that kind of came from an event that you would feel fits into the world of humanities.
Absolutely. And again, around the idea of liberal education and liberal arts education, that's certainly something that we passionately believe in, that we also attempt to promote here. And we are advocates for humanities education. And as I mentioned earlier, I think often the humanities has, in the world of education and in the narratives having to do with economics, has really gotten a bad shake. And it's misinformed. It's quite myopic. And we really do believe that a humanities education is, as it always has been, at the foreground of problem solving, And the methodologies that we teach regarding both problem solving and effective communication are fundamental for a prosperous economic career. What we typically see, unlike when you and I were coming up through our education and our parents and grandparents and people moved into a kind of one career trajectory, what happens now is people change jobs multiple times and the nature of their jobs change multiply as well. So people have to be adaptable. And one of the things one learns in a humanities education or liberal arts education more broadly is to have those adaptability skills. When I was dean at University of Utah, I used to go around to the major educator or the employers in Utah and ask them what in their entry level people that were coming out of our university do they see the biggest gaps in? And almost every employer would say they don't write well, or they don't communicate well, or they don't know how to think out of a box. And they would say, you know, we need the fundamental skills and we could train them in the technical and technological skills once they're on the job. But those kind of fundamental critical thinking skills, creative thinking skills, communication skills, problem solving skills, those are the things that one learns in a broad-based humanities liberal arts education. And those are the prescription for, I think, prosperous employment over the years and adaptability, which is what one needs in today's job force.
Have you ever had government employees or political staff people come to you and ask advice or seek information that might help a government leader like the president or a senator or a high level government person? Have they sent people to you seeking information or seeking guidance that might help them make decisions or take directions in a humanities style for the benefit of their constituents?
Yes. So we regularly are visited by Congressman David Price, who is our congressman in this district. And we have been also visited by now Congresswoman Deborah Ross, who is in Wake County and that surrounding area, who's the new congresswoman for that district as well. Both of whom are passionate advocates for the humanities and also promote further funding for the National Endowment for the Humanities, which is, of course, a federal agency in Washington. We also advocate, I go to Capitol Hill on an annual basis to advocate our representatives and senators on behalf of the National Endowment for the Humanities to promote a more broad-based humanities focus curriculum for scholarship, et cetera. We also participate on a regular basis in various sort of think tanks, working with other foundations, and also working with other agencies that have a kind of academic bent like ours to promote more broadly for the significance, the importance of the humanities to counter, again, this kind of misinformed, myopic, largely economically misaligned information that's out there. But I think the whole nature, to broaden your question, the whole nature of what constitutes good government is very much a humanities question. What constitutes a civil society? What constitutes civil discourse? These are humanities questions that need purposing and investigation and broader translation. If we think about just the history of, again, our Constitution, James Madison, when he was writing the Constitution, went back to his history textbooks, and he was trying to figure out what makes a republic survive. And he looked at the various republics, the Roman Republic, the Dutch Republic, what have you, that all failed. And of course, he wanted the Republic of the United States not to fail. And he came up through investigating and researching through his history textbooks, the system of checks and balances with the three branches of government that we now have. That was the result of a humanities task and humanities investigation and historical research. So these things are extremely translatable. They are foundational when we think about community and the idea of community, the idea of neighborhood, the idea of extended family. These are very much humanities-based ideas, as is the entire investigation of what constitutes the human condition. That is the purpose of the humanities, is to investigate the human condition in all of its complexities, in all of its difficulties. And I think I like to say there are two fundamental methodologies that we see over and over again in the humanities. One is interrogation. So we're never comfortable with what is. We're always interrogating it. We're always asking questions. How can we do it better? How might we do it differently? The other one's bridging, looking at things that are usually considered to be disparate and unrelated and figuring out relationships between those things, which is what community does as well. So the humanities is just so ingrained in all the good that we have done and that we hope to do.
Where does the National Endowment of Humanities fit into our government structure and in government decisions and activities that are going on? Where's the endowment fit?
So the National Endowment for the Humanities, like the National Endowment for the Arts, both federal agencies. We are, of course, an independent nonprofit, so we are not a federal agency, although we do get some funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Their budgets are quite minuscule, both the National Endowment for the Humanities and the National Endowment for the Arts, although in the past couple of years they've grown slightly. But they are challenged in every budgetary session. In the past 4 years, there was an attempt to eradicate both of those agencies by those who were in charge. I don't think we're going to see that under the current administration, and I think I'm hoping that they will be further bolstered. So they are significant federal agencies. Although they've often been challenged and there have been attempts to render them peripheral because, you know, the culture wars that have been going on over the past few decades have rendered them a kind of straw agency, as it were.
One of your strongest programs, as I looked at your website, seems to be your fellow programs. And in looking at the people who have been fellows and also looking at the way you apply to become a fellow, it's a challenge just to become appointed as a fellow. There's a lot of preparation that you hope that you put together in order to apply to become a fellow. And The fellows seem to be an absolute dynamic way for someone to spend some time.
Yeah,
living on the campus and being just a part of that environment.
Yeah, I like to call this intellectual nirvana here.
A good phrase.
Yeah, so I think, you know, people. We have testimonies, of course, from our former fellows that say this has been the year that they spend here, and we also do exit surveys, and we do surveys like 3 years out, 5 years out, et cetera. And almost to a person, they say this was the most productive year of their lives. One of the things that I say during orientation to all of our fellows that were so successful to get here is I say to them, what I want you to do is to work on the book that you've always wanted to do. You will be as free this year as you will ever be in your entire academic careers, because you're not teaching. You're not worried about departmental politics and going to department meetings or university politics, what have you. Your focus entirely is to work on this project. And we have a tremendous library services that help our fellows get anything that they need from anywhere in the world to work on those projects. And to a person, they say this has been the most productive 9 months of their entire careers. The selection process, as you indicated, is extremely rigorous, but it's also quite unique. So what we do is we get between 600 and 700, as I said, proposals from all over the world on an annual basis. All of those proposals then go out to three reviewers that are in the particular discipline of the proposal. So a proposal, for example,
you have this widespread group of reviewers you have to deal with.
Yes, so we use typically 500. Last year, for this year's class, we used 540 reviewers. Now, our fellows are so positive about their experience here that they volunteer to be reviewers. So we often use a lot of former fellows as reviewers, and they know what this is about and what we're looking for. But other academics, prominent academics as well. So the first stage of the review process is going out to these three reviewers in the field. And based on the scores and the narratives that we get back from those reviewers, we boil the list of applicants down to around 100 finalists. And then we bring in to the center for 2 days, a selection committee, which changes annually. And it's an interdisciplinary selection committee. So people from different fields in the humanities, 6 people. And they adjudicate those 100 proposals, and we come up with the roughly 35 or so fellows that we're going to make offers to for the fellowship year based on that. So there are two things the proposal has to do. One, it has to speak to people in the field itself, to experts in the field, but it also has to be written in a way that is appealing to a broad interdisciplinary audience of scholars. So it can't be full of jargon. A philosopher has to understand what a literary scholar is doing, for example, for it to get the endorsement to be selected. And, you know, we have people from all over the world here. We've enhanced the international dynamic considerably. For next year's class, for example, we have fellows from 27 different institutions in the United States who are representing 16 different states. And we also have 6 scholars from abroad, including a scholar from Nigeria, a scholar from Greece, a scholar from Germany, a scholar from Taiwan, and 2 scholars from Hong Kong coming here next year. And we like to think of the humanities very, very broadly construed. So it's not just literature and philosophy and history. We have scholars here that are doing music theory, that are doing legal ethics, that are doing medical ethics, that are doing architectural history. So it's a wide variety of projects, some of which are broadly interdisciplinary and some of which are very esoterically narrow in a particular discipline. We cover that whole range. But if you look at our past fellows, it's kind of a who's who of the most prominent scholars that have been in the humanities for the past 40 years.
I see it. So is the international world expanding? You mentioned fellows from other countries. Is this expanding this relationship between your center and other similar centers in the, either Western countries or countries that Middle East or Asia? Is that expanding at all?
Yeah, so in two different dimensions. One, the profile of the center with, as a result of, you know, people knowing more about us because of our public engagement activities and our education activities, we have more people from abroad applying to be fellows here. And two, we are part of an organization of the most prominent and prestigious centers for advanced studies, no matter what the discipline, in largely the Western world. So there are 10 institutions, and from the United States, it's the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton, the Center for Social and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies, and us. And we are with Centers for Advanced Studies from the Netherlands, from Germany, from Israel, from South Africa, from France, from Sweden. So we meet on an annual basis, the directors of those various institutes, to talk about, you know, what's going on in our various disciplines at our centers, to trade best practices. As you might imagine, during a pandemic year, which has been so challenging, and we've had to go virtual to a great degree, trading best practices has been extremely important. So we have built a kind of community of the most prominent and prestigious institutes for advanced studies, largely in the Western world, at this point, of which we are a very significant member.
Well, in relation to what you're talking about, the Western world, do you look at your unit of Western institutes as competing with other human societies that might have been developed in different cultures, Southeast Asia cultures or Absolutely. African cultures?
Yeah, so very good question. So we have scholars here from Asia on a regular basis. We have a grant from the Luce Foundation that brings us three scholars from East Asia on a regular basis, on an annual basis here. We have a relationship with the Stellenbosch Institute for Advanced Studies in South Africa that brings us a scholar from Africa here on a regular basis as well. And we would add to the group that I just mentioned, the group of 10, probably more institutions from the eastern part of the world. We're gradually adding institutions, but they have to meet very, very rigorous requirements in terms of the prestige of their fellowship program. So we look forward to bringing Eastern institutions, more Eastern institutions into that group, but we do have fellows from all over the world here, and scholarship that is being done amongst our fellows that crosses oceans and crosses countries on a routine basis. So we have diversified what we do to a great degree. And one of the indications of that is the representation of institutions that we bring here. So humanities research is not just restricted to elite institutions. So we will have scholars from, you know, the top Ivy Leagues and the top public institutions, but we also welcome proposals from four-year liberal arts colleges, from smaller state universities, and it's the quality of the project and the quality of the scholarship that we're looking for. One of the programs that we started a couple of years ago with a grant from the Mellon Foundation was to bring four scholars from historically Black colleges and universities here on an annual basis. So we do that as well. And you know, often those institutions were not represented at the National Humanities Center. So we take diversity very, very seriously in terms of those places and scholars and educators to whom we're reaching out and who we bring here also. And the various kinds of programs that we're doing have increasingly had a kind of more contemporary flavor. So one of the things that we wanted to do when I first got here was to broaden the demographics of who comes to attend public events at the National Humanities Center. And it used to be primarily retired academics who would come in the evening to attend a scholarly talk. So the first conference we put on when I came in was called Novel Sounds, and it was about rock and roll and its influence on contemporary American literature. And we did that not just with scholars talking about rock and roll, but we had concerts at UNC with Richard Thompson, one of the greatest rock musicians in rock history, and Steve Earle, another one as well, who also participated in panels, as well as Grail Marcus, who wrote the biography of Elvis Presley, was here, as well as Jonathan Latham, who did novels that were very much based in rock and roll. And we took that and we used that as a kind of base point for the kinds of conferences that we're doing leading up to the Artificial Intelligence Conference. We did a conference on climate change in the humanities called Beyond Despair a couple of years ago, where we brought in scientists as well as historians to talk about how the humanities might play an intervention in the probably the most crucial problem that's facing mankind, that is climate change. And that conference drew people from all over the world who kind of tuned in virtually. And it has been repurposed in some of our podcast series as well. So people go to it on our website where it's archived very frequently to answer some of these questions. We did a conference also called North Carolina, the New Heartland, where the argument essentially was Kansas was always considered the heartland of the United States. And the argument of this conference was actually North Carolina is more of a bellwether state regarding the various changes that are going on in the state, both economic and educational and cultural and demographically as well. So let's do a conference on that. And we used three humanities lenses to investigate how North Carolina was becoming more and more the kind of epicenter and heartland and microcosm of the United States. We used storytelling, music culture, and food culture. And with food culture, we had representatives from various refugee populations in North Carolina come in and cook their food for conference attendees and talk about their personal stories, their migratory patterns, their experiences as refugees coming to this country and to this state as well. And you know, music has been has such a fundamental influence on North Carolina. So, you know, we had music from the mountains as well as music from the coast. As well as music from the triangle and the heartland of North Carolina as well. Former Governor Jim Hunt was one of our keynote speakers, as was Congressman David Price. So again, part of the intention here is to reach out to the broadest possible constituencies to ingrain in them the idea and the understanding that the humanities are so fundamental to what we do, who we are, and what we aspire to be.
Well, that's interesting. One of my friends and also a periodic radio guest is Orrin Pilkey, mm-hmm. who's a student, a retired professor from Duke, studying coastlines worldwide, and he's a advocate of climate change information and a student of the coastline situation, the Outer Banks, particularly in North Carolina. And that's part of your the thing that you're talking about, relationships among the various portions of an institution, meaning the state of North Carolina being the institution.
Correct. Very much so.
And I think my wife paid a visit to your organization some years ago. Her father was well known back in the 30s. And through the 60s at Duke, J.B. Ryan, who developed the world of parapsychology, and there's still an institution in Durham, the Ryan Research Center, not part of Duke, but a research center studying the world of consciousness and parapsychology and extrasensory perception and those kind of things that kind of got a a big start back in the 30s through the 60s at Duke through J.V. Rhine's activities and those who worked with him. So these ideas are out there, and what you're telling our listeners today is that the ideas that are there can be made into human assets, not just ideas floating in the periphery in the cloud, as they say, but can be translated into human assets.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. That indeed, yes.
You mentioned.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Before we bail out of here, you mentioned public schools. Can you give us a little example of the type of work that you do with public education, particularly high school teachers and academic classes in public and private and religious schools?
Sure. We do various webinars during the course of the year. We focused to a great degree on the pandemic and the history of pandemics this year. Changes in culture, changes in educational institutions that occur during pandemics. We have had a big focus on issues of racial injustice, given the Black Lives Matter movement, given what's happened with violence to Asian Americans. We feel that the idea of racial injustice is something that needs to be better explored and translated more efficaciously in the classroom as well. So we've done various curricular materials, various webinars. We've done things, the history of slave narratives in the country also. What we attempt to do is to communicate with various teachers across the country and to also ask them, what do they need? And what's relevant and what can they use the most? I remember our education director told me a story last year where our website went down for a day and he was getting frantic calls from teachers throughout the country who so depend on accessing our materials that they were wondering when the website was going to come back up, because you know, there's such good materials there from all different kinds of lenses that they can sort of pick and choose and cut and paste to put in their sort of daily lesson plans. But you know, what we're about is really elevating the consciousness of the general public, which I think is so fundamental to what the humanities is about. We don't rest in certainty, unlike the sciences, which are always trying to achieve a sense of certainty. We are very much resting in uncertainty and always sort of pushing the envelope, challenging what's there. So nothing's really ever static in the humanities. We're always morphing. And it's very dynamic and interesting that way, because I think indeed lives do morph and the world changes and the human condition is very nuanced and sometimes confusing. So what we're doing is investigating those confusions and trying to make sense of things as well as trying to problem solve. And I think I should also say that what I think we're very much based in is promoting a sense of empathy and community. So what reading does is it gets you to travel in your mind where you can't sort of necessarily physically travel, and to sort of reach out and understand other points of view and other places. And that's fundamental and foundational to what the humanities is about.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sorry we have to shut the gate in a minute or two. I did notice in your website, your personal website, that you've made a lot of speeches over the last, at least once a year, there's at least one speech you make. Is that something you make at the Institute, or something people invite you outside of your of your world and you give a talk to other groups or other audiences?
So both. I do give talks here, but I am frequently invited to speak at town halls, to speak at independent bookstores, to give the annual humanities lecture at a university. So I do a lot of speaking across the country and actually sometimes across the world. Again, talking about the importance of the humanities in life, as well as the future of the humanities, and how they're so much ingrained in finding good solutions to world problems. So we can have all the technological advances in the world, but the question of the ethics behind whether or not to implement those technological advances or where to implement them, those are all humanities questions. So that's part of what I try to address in the various talks I give.
Terrific. Well, I'd like to thank a few organizations for supporting this station, but I won't mention any names today because it's about time to turn the power off. But next week we'll have another interesting conversation. And I'm not going to tell you about it because it's too long to describe in the minute we have left, but be sure to tune in next Monday at this time. And for this Monday at this time, I'd like to thank Dr. Robert Newman for a terrific conversation. It's been great talking with you, and maybe I'll stop in someday and say hello.
You're always welcome, Bill. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it very much. We'll be right back.